From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
English is a mongrel language. We have no purity. We began with Celtic, then came the Romans, then came the Jutes and the Danes and the Angles and the Saxons. And if berserk comes from Icelandic and if ketchup comes from Cantonese, so be it.
That was the philosophy of the Oxford English Dictionary back in the 19th century. The editors set out on a nearly impossible mission to describe how every word in the language was ever used. Today, we'll talk with best-selling author Simon Winchester about the remarkable history of the OED. Also, how English became a global language. And a conversation with master wordsmith Billy Collins. He makes writing poetry look easy. But don't tell him that.
I have lots of false starts, poems that just don't seem to have anywhere to go, or they lack momentum. There's no run of meaning. The associations aren't working. So I just generally pitch it as a bad attempt.
But first, spoken word poetry and why it's creating a new generation of writers.
I am on a journey to my soul, but the police just pulled me over. It's kind of funny if you think about the fact that I wasn't even driving, but seated at my desk, yet apparently I was speeding. 30, 40, 50 light years past the speed limit, and I didn't even realize it. See, I've been doing this poetry so long, I actually thought I could find myself through it. Going back, the proverbial return, where my ego and self reform their original wholeness. I just have to look past all these mass murderers that masquerade as teachers and leaders, killing my dreams of self-knowledge with images of destruction and fear. Coding my subconscious has got my unconscious in a fit. It makes me nervous just to go out in public. It gives me nightmares until I have to sit here and write them away. But I think my computer must be bugged.
That's Paul Flores with a poem called I Am on a Journey to My Soul, but the police just pulled me over. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Flores and Mark Bamudi Joseph, two spoken word poets from the San Francisco Bay Area. Flores says spoken word is revolutionizing the literary landscape.
This is the voice of America, per se, right now. This is how we express ourselves idiomatically, linguistically, rhythmically. It's a form that speaks to a specific generation. Call it Generation X, call it MTV generation, call it post-hip-hop, call it whatever.
So what makes really good spoken word?
I feel like, you know, when you get on stage, because that's where spoken word lives. Spoken word lives on stage. It doesn't live on the page. Spoken word is meant to be performed. And so really, bottom line, just bus.
if you, it either works or doesn't work.
Either you're going to get on stage and bust your poem, or you're going to go up there and you're going to recite your poem. You go up on stage and you do it as hard and as good and as emotional and as performative as possible. You know, that's where your poem's going to live. You got 3.5 minutes to go up there and impress somebody with your ability to communicate a story, your ability to present your life, someone else's life. And it's about a very short time, you making me feel you. It doesn't mean you have to go really fast. When you talk, it doesn't mean you have to use your hand gestures. Like, it just means you have to put all of your body on stage into your words and embody the words.
So as an audience member, I'm going to hopefully have some sense of who you are after listening to you for 3.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. The true standard for spoken word really is how present can a performer be with not only the language, but the audience. In other words, the object, I think, of a spoken word performer is to transform that space, you know, and create a moment that, you know, that we can all share. Yeah. And I think that's a huge power of the word, is to invite and to engage and ultimately to transform.
Could you give us a moment right now? You are both masters at this whole tradition of spoken word. Would you be up for giving us an example?
In this moment, let's talk about this political moment, right? Where there are insidious idiots eliciting innocence to integrate irrational nationalism into a colonized mind state. Hindsight will highlight a high rate of heil to a thief. Unabashedly fascists are making their way through a matrix of mayhem, and mediocre men are amending civil liberties to legitimize piracy on our privacy. The only thing still free in this piece is speech, so each word must reach worlds like spring birds with wings hurled against the curling torrent of a maddening rain, happening habitually like ritual of pain. That's the moment. You want me to tell you again?
So you could just kind of have these different pieces. I don't know what you call them, poems, or that you could just kind of draw on when the moment is right.
Well, yeah, the poems are the experience. Just like you draw on your memories, you know, for me, it's not just a memory, but it's the art that really heals and expresses who I am. So I draw on that to guide me through a day.
Well, one thing that's striking is you're sort of laid back and kind of calm as we're just talking. But, you know, once you flip on the switch and you're performing, there's a different you that comes out. And for one thing, there's an angrier performer there.
Well, the times demand. The times do not demand stagnancy. You
know, I think there's a difference between passion and anger. I feel like, you know, a lot of people put the label of angry poet on a spoken word artist because they have to communicate so passionately what they're feeling. Otherwise, they don't get their points across. So it often gets mistaken as anger. I don't necessarily think that anger is always present in the writing, but there is necessarily passion in the performance.
Well, we heard Mark earlier give us a little sample of his thing. Can we hear something from you, Paul?
Okay. My language is my muse. My language is sweet, too, like a smile you were happy to see, like a hello you didn't anticipate, like good news, like sex in the morning and the afternoon, like someone to talk to, like someone who will listen unconditionally. My language is honest. What you see is what you get. I won't try to hide my weaknesses through gimmicks. I'm not perfect, but if you give me a 10, I'll take it. My desires are often obvious. What I say might sound bullish, but I'm a Taurus, and I want you to know where I stand. I believe in first impressions, though I've been proven wrong before. I don't believe in God, but sometimes I pray. The cross that hung from my grandfather's neck as my grandmother lay paralyzed for 10 years. I believe in love at first sight, at least for one night. I'll give you the benefit of a doubt if you do the same for me. My language is safe sex, birth control, and monogamy. My language is sentimental. I'm romantic to a fault. My mother used to read Danielle Steele novels, and I used to sneak a read for the sex parts. Oh, my mother must have fantasized about making love to Fabio. I must have inherited her hopelessness by osmosis. Does that mean that I fantasized about making love to Fabio too? They say if you wear your heart on your sleeve, don't get mad if someone rips it off. Well, there must be holes in my soul, but I ain't mad. I am more than the only child of an absent father. I just don't know how to get over it. I've been suffering an identity crisis since I was 4, but like the sun rising over these mean streets, I am born anew at each AM.
Wow.
Word up.
Now, you've both said that this whole moment that we're in now of spoken word kind of comes out of the hip-hop experience. Is this rap that you're doing, or is this something different?
This is not rap for me. Rapping, I feel, are lyrics that are made to put to music, that rhyme. They employ, I guess, a lyrical base that's associated to the beat that you're working to. My stuff is more narrative in a lot of senses. I mean, the piece I just did right there was kind of an excerpt from something about myself. But, you know, being able to switch up, you know, rhyming schemes and, you know, just what is being spoken about often is very different.
Now, Mark, for you, do you see what you do as a spoken word artist coming out of any particular tradition?
Yes. What I do comes out of the drum and also out of the quill. You know what I mean? Like it comes from the Black artist movement in the 60s and the Harlem Renaissance and in the 20s. I was first moved into poetry by the work of Sonia Sanchez, the work of Nikki Giovanni, and the work of Amiri Baraka. and found County Cullen and found Langston Hughes and also found a certain lyricism in the work of Zora Neale Hurston that I could relate to. Later, it was that same lyricism, you know, that I found in Toni Morrison's work that made me fall in love with language. And so idiomatically, I probably, you know, speak in, work in most closely the tradition of hip hop. You know, mm-hmm. that was the musical background while I was growing up in the Reagan era. You know what I mean?
Right. But it's so interesting to hear you talk about your literary influences. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people who lived, you know, 60 or 70 years ago, mm-hmm. a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's that tradition. You know, Paul spoke the word continuum, and I think it's one of the reasons why we both work with young people, because we believe that the word does reach as far back as humanity does and necessarily will extend forward. And so, you know, we implicitly and explicitly bring these traditions into the writing workshops that we do with young folks.
That's really important. I feel like we're trying to take the larger issues and really, or the smaller issues and make them larger. And the personal become the political and the public. And I mean, we're not trying to turn kids into superstars. That's not what we want to do. We have a couple rules in the workshop. One is that there are no wrong answers. There are no wrong answers. What you write is your truth. The second one is the standard is yourself. You don't have to be anybody else. You don't have to act like anybody else. You don't have to write like anybody else. You know, it's more about, you know, who you are and how you represent yourself.
But let me follow up on that, because there is this whole other tradition for, I mean, not so much teenagers, but like you two, I know, have performed in poetry slams, mm-hmm. which is very competitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to try to top you. You're sort of putting it out there, you know, see if you can match this. And so that's a very different impulse. And I guess I'm curious about how important the competitive nature is in all of this.
Literature is very competitive no matter where you go.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you're trying to publish a poem in a journal, whether you're trying to get a established writer to read your work, whether you're trying to stay off the slush pile, whether you're trying to win a poetry slam, whether you're just trying to get on the mic, it's all competitive.
Mm. Try to get a book deal.
You know what I mean? You know, it's like what spoken word allows you to do and what the poetry slam allows you to do is find a relatively equal base where people can get on the mic. And you have to realize that when you're in a poetry slam, you're playing a game. Mm-hmm. And games have rules.
Do you both get off on that game? I mean, do you like to compete?
You know what? I like to compete, but I played soccer. You know what I mean? Like I played soccer, you know, through college, and I love sports. I'll, you know, ESPN all day, all night. But I don't write poetry to compete. And I say that, and, you know, we run one of the largest poetry slams in the country. I won the National Poetry Slam a few years ago, you know, but I honestly get much more of a charge in the theater space than in a poetry slam space, because there's the opportunity to create an extended narrative and really push mm-hmm. an aesthetic and perception of what we can do with verse. So what I get off on is communicating ideas that hopefully will transform the world.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what about you?
I'll say that I enjoy the poetry slam a lot. I don't write poems for Poetry Slam, but I will have to shape them down to make sure that they get to the time allotted that you have for a poem, you know, 3 minutes, 10 seconds. So that will determine what you write and at what point are you going to reach your climax in the poem that is supposed to communicate the gist of what you want. The other thing I enjoy about the Poetry Slam is that, coming from an academic background, I have an MFA in creative writing. You know, I'm a professional poet. I know how to write an acceptable poem. I had to unlearn all of that, really, because in school, what you're learning is really the craft of poetry. You're not learning the craft of communication, of captivating an audience, of making somebody hear you, of connecting to their experience. What I enjoy about Poetry Slam is that my poetry has to relate to the lowest common denominator. Mm. I have to find something that everyone will connect to. That is very difficult to do. To go into a bar where nobody knows who you are and get them all to stand up on their feet and clap for you, give you good scores, that's almost impossible to do. You put any, you know, of the so-called academic poets in a bar like that, and people will fall asleep. You know what I mean? You know, how do I make the Latino experience palatable to middle America? How do I make it palatable to Asian people? That's what the Poetry Slam will challenge you to do. I mean, I've read Billy Collins' work, and, you know, and I could say I enjoyed a few poems, but If Billy can't get up and bust, then don't come on a spoken word stage. Right. You know what I mean?
Paul Flores and Mark Mahmoudi Joseph are spoken word poets from the San Francisco Bay Area. They talk to Steve Paulson.
Her head swings slowly back like the sun can't get enough of her. Skin slowly down, disbelieving. Bedrock backbone, black bone ache. Me in her relieved release swing back. The pendulum song, raspberry singing too sweet. Her body blank page, seeking the words.
You're listening to Mark Mahmoudi Joseph. The poem is called Late.
Baby, you got out in time, right? In time, right? In time, the night will crawl into my throat and rise as taste. The night sits inside my closed mouth like the night she sat open mouthed, open hearts beating in time. But niggas can't never be on time, so no surprise when she tells me she's late.
Does Billy Collins bust? You can decide for yourself. Later this hour, we'll hear from the former poet laureate.
I'm shameless about courting the attention of a reader. I think poetry is such a solitary activity that if I didn't have at least the illusion of some reader's companionship, I think I'd, you know, start climbing the walls.
Also, the amazing story of the Oxford English Dictionary. That's next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When the Oxford English Dictionary was created in 1857, it was supposed to be finished within a decade. It took 71 years to bring out the first edition. And the OED became one of the most remarkable stories in the history of publishing, a story that Simon Winchester tells in his book, The Meaning of Everything. The central figure in this story is a high school dropout named James Murray. He edited the dictionary for nearly 40 years, until his death in 1915. Winchester says from the very beginning, Murray refused to cut corners, even when his publishers pressured him to speed things along.
They wanted him to produce 33 words a day, and he said to them, look, the English language is a fearsomely complicated beast. It has taken me 4.5 days to write the full definition, etymology, for the word black. Now, black may seem to you simple. It's terribly complicated. I understand your commercial pressures, but for you to say to me, I've got to do 33 words a day, or I've got to do any number a day, is simply unrealistic. I, gentlemen, will work at the pace the language requires, and I'm not going to cut corners. And if you don't agree with that, then you can get rid of me. Well, that attitude, it at first astonished Oxford University Press, who had never been spoken to that way, least of all by a man who was essentially uneducated, hadn't got a degree, certainly hadn't got an Oxford degree, and was from Scotland, of all places. But he stared them down, and in the end they backed down and said, OK, you go at the pace the language requires.
This was a new idea, was it not, for a dictionary? I mean, there were dictionaries up to this point, Samuel Johnson's famous dictionary. By this time, Merriam-Webster had a dictionary out. But what they were trying to accomplish with this was something entirely new.
It was. For a start, they looked at such dictionaries as existed, like Johnson, like Merriam-Webster, and realized that these were wanting in all sorts of ways. For one, Johnson only contained 40,000 words and Webster 70,000, and there was a hunch, there was no certainty about it, but there was a hunch that the English language was rather larger than 40,000 or 70,000 words. Then again, the internal arrangements of the dictionaries were unsatisfactory. Their definitions were often wrong. They were inaccurate. They were politically biased. They just weren't very good products. And so the people in the Philological Society of London, which had lately been set up to study the language, said, look, let us produce a dictionary in which every single word in the language, with every sense and every meaning, a perfect etymology, absolutely exquisite definitions, everything is incorporated. But it was also different in another and more philosophical way. Previously, most dictionaries, not all, but most, had prescribed how the language ought to be spoken and how words ought to be used, which is the approach that the French still take and the Italians still take. They seek to protect the purity of their language. The editors of what was to be the Oxford English Dictionary, in those days it was called the New English Dictionary, said no. That, in the specific case of English, is not realistic, because English is a mongrel language. We have no purity. We began with Celtic, then came the Romans, then came the Jutes and the Danes and the Frisians and the Angles and the Saxons, then came the French, then we started going out into the world and bringing back words with us. And if berserk comes from Icelandic and if ketchup comes from Cantonese, so be it. We will not prescribe how the language should be spoken. We will simply describe how it actually is spoken. But to do that, to describe how every word in the language has ever been used, we have to read everything that's ever been written. So that was the starting point. It was a very massive task they set themselves.
It's extraordinary that they even thought it was possible to do that. I mean, maybe we ought to talk a little bit about the way in which the editors decided, in fact, to go about creating the dictionary. The first editor was who? Herbert Coleridge?
Well, the first editor was Herbert Coleridge, and he only lasted for a year. He was a very sickly young man, although very intelligent. He laid down the organizational plan. He sent out thousands upon thousands of little brochures to libraries and bookshops and schools and universities all over the English-speaking world. So not only England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland, but also the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa. Wherever people spoke or read English, these brochures said to them, look, we're starting this immense and, we believe, noble project to make a dictionary of everything in the English language. Help us. What we want you to do is read and look for words that interest you. They can be prepositions or they can be sesquipedalian monsters. It doesn't matter. But what you want to do is to take a sheet of paper, 5 inches by 7, put the interesting word at the top left, then put the quotation that you have found that incorporates that word in a way that you think illustrates how that word was used. Well, this plan was an unqualified success because within a very few weeks, thousands, hundreds of thousands of these slips of paper, which are the key to the making of this dictionary, started flowing in. Coleridge thought he could accommodate these in a set of pigeonholes, which he made out of wood. 9 pigeonholes wide, 6 deep, 54 pigeonholes, he thought, should do it. I cannot tell you what an underestimate that was. Anyway, he died. Clearly the task completely overwhelmed him. He was then replaced by another man who, called Frederick Furnival, who was a wonderful fellow, but completely bad, dreadful at organizing, not least because he was fascinated by so many other things. And he managed to start losing all these slips of paper, by which time there were now about 2 tons of pieces of paper.
It's clear to me that one of the things that you've enjoyed about writing this book is having the opportunity to increase your vocabulary. I was just thinking about it because of your use of a word for a multisyllabic word just a moment ago,
sesquipedalian.
Sesquipedalian, which yes, I think is not a common word defined in conversation.
Well, that's part of the joy of our language. And I do think, I'm trying to make a serious point here, that we in broadcasting and writing and journalism and so forth do have some kind of duty to keep the language alive. My old news editor at The Guardian, when I worked there, used to pin up a word, an unusual word, on the bulletin board every Monday morning. And to the first reporter who got it legitimately into his copy that week, he would award a pint of beer. So this idea of trawling the great sweep net through the language and coming up with choice and lovely words and putting them into one's speech or one's writing, I think is a jolly good idea.
You talk about these slips disappearing, essentially, after Furnival got in charge of the project, because Furnival couldn't carry it through, could he?
He really couldn't. I mean, he was forever chasing women. This was the downfall of many, but particularly the downfall of Mr. Furnival. He was very keen on a particular form of rowing, sculling. He loved sculling, and he loved then encouraging young women to go sculling. This and a dozen other interests of his made him essentially take his eye off the ball so far as the dictionary was concerned. The slips were lost. He got into all sorts of trouble with the publishers. He eventually had to be sacked. And in his place was the man, James Murray, plucked from essentially nowhere. He was a schoolmaster, had been unhappily at a bank, left school at 14, self-educated, but a towering intellect, tremendously prodigious knowledge of languages, and superb organizational skills. He found all the missing slips. He got them back. His wife wouldn't have him in the house, or wouldn't have them in the house, erected a tin shed that she bought from a gardening catalogue in the back garden. He put 10,000 pigeonholes along the walls of the hut, and that was where the dictionary was essentially born. He called this hut the Scriptorium, which was the name that monks used to give the place where they illuminated manuscripts.
It is actually a very nice image to think of Murray in what was essentially an oversized potting shed growing a dictionary, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. But the first volume came out in 1884, after he had been working for 5 years with one assistant, a man called Sidney Hurtig, who had to be fired because he was a kleptomaniac. There are lots of maniacs in this story. I mean, lexicography attracts very, very strange people. But with Hurtig's help and then another assistant, he brought out the first part. This was the words between A and Ant, and that was 8,350 words.
What was included in that first volume? To get that many words from so few letters, did we have to include obscure words, words that were unlikely to be used, or was this simply a recognition of the existing usable language of the English-speaking peoples?
That's a very important distinction you make. These were all the words, not words that were in current use. These were all the words that ever had been used. And within that volume, there's one charming word, I think, but the use has fallen away, but it's charming because it's one of the very few illustrations of wit in the OED, although it was inadvertent wit, and that's the second sense of the noun abbreviator. I mean, the first sense is obvious, something that abbreviates something, but the second sense is very peculiar. It's a junior official at the Vatican whose duties include drawing up the Pope's briefs. Sorry, I think we'll pause for that one.
Yes, but I think we have to let that one just kind of have its own
But it
moment.
Was an inadvertent piece of wit because it was defined thus by Murray in 1881. The use of the word briefs to mean underwear only became current in 1933. So it was inadvertent wit, but wit nonetheless.
Well, in fact, one of Murray's great distinctions is that he was able to write definitions that still make sense 100 years since he put them down. And in fact, he was able to distill the sense of words in a way that most of his colleagues could not, I gather.
He was brilliant in the sense of definitions. And if you go to look at any one of the definitions of words up to and including T, because he died essentially having completed the word 20th in 1915. I mean, his skills were passed on to his successors, but some of his definitions were absolutely majestic. If you look, and I can't quote it from memory, but if you look at, for instance, the definition of the word black, which is a very difficult word to define if you think of it carefully, it's just beautiful. You look at it and say, that's it. That's absolutely right. Mind you, there are some who argue today that many of the definitions and certainly the quotations reflect the imperial, masculine, and possibly racist temper of the time. You look at not so much the definitions, but the quotations that are amassed to illustrate meanings of words like Jew, and woman and savage. They're somewhat questionable, but they were corrected in the 1989 edition. But nonetheless, one important thing to say is that no word is ever dropped from the OED. So this is a record of everything that is and everything that ever was.
The OED's third edition, all 40 volumes of it, is due out in the year 2037. Simon Winchester's book is called The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary.
I will tell of the Battle of Hastings.
Folk singer Tony Barrett.
King Harold, he came up when they landed, his face full of venom and hate, and he said, if you've come for regatta, you've got here just 6 weeks too late. Well, at this, William rose, cool but haughty, and said, let's have none of your cheek. You'd best have your throne reupholstered. I'll be wanting to use it next week. Well, when Harold heard this here defiance, with rage he turned purple and blue, and he shouted some rude words in Saxon, to which William answered, and you.
If you're Japanese and you're doing business in Germany, chances are the language you'll use to close the deal is English. And if Swedish and Belgian diplomats are hammering out new laws for the European Union, how do they talk to each other? In English, most likely. So why has English become the world's dominant language?
In one word, because the English speakers have had all the luck.
Abram de Swan is a Dutch sociologist who studies the politics of language. He told Steve Paulson that English is so widespread because the British Empire once ruled over vast stretches of the earth, and now the U.S. is the global power that all countries must contend with. De Swan says the popularity of English has little to do with the language itself.
I don't think there's anything in English which makes it especially suitable to be a world language. If you and I were a committee which had to pick a world language, we would right away reject English for the simple reason that the orthography is totally impossible, the spelling.
Now, there were various European countries that were colonial powers. It wasn't just the British. It was the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese.
Yeah.
But those languages have not had nearly as much influence as English, in recent decades at least.
No, but on the whole, colonial languages have proved remarkably tenacious and resistant in the sense that Brazil still speaks Portuguese, the rest of Latin America speaks Spanish. In India, which is a huge population, approaching 1 billion, English still is the official language, competing with its much more numerous rival, which is Hindi. Throughout West Africa, French has maintained its position, and there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, in all these colonies, there was an administration recruited in the final phases from native people, the native elites. After independence, they wanted to retain that colonial language as their collective monopoly, as an access to the civil service examinations for their children, therefore for the best jobs in the land. Secondly, there was the liberation movement, and the various nations and ethnies that came together in the liberation movement could only understand one another in the language of the colonizer, which they mobilized in their anti-colonial struggle.
It's an incredible irony.
Yes, it is.
I mean, they're trying to kick out the colonizer, but
using the language. That's correct. Now, after independence, of course, there was a debate everywhere, shouldn't we have an indigenous language that sprang from our own soil? Everybody agreed in public. The next question was, which one? And the answer invariably was, not yours. So, for example, in Senegal, where 80% of the people speak Wolof, as soon as the subject arises, should Wolof become the official language of Senegal, the Serer, the Toucouleur, the Diola say, no, certainly not. We're not going to give this recognition to one of our rival nations. And therefore, French remains.
Now, it's fascinating to think about the politics of this because it almost sounds like the colonizer's language would have been vilified long as the colonizer was in power. So I assume that in India, for instance, that Indians must have hated English just
they still
as they loathed the English. They would do anything to get the British out of the country.
Oh, yes.
But as soon as the English leave, then the English language becomes more acceptable.
Well, they still feel very bad about the fact that English holds such an important position, although the southern states use it in order to prevent the total victory of Hindi. So it still is a very contested situation. I think that we should propose to them another metaphor. We should say, we kicked the English out of India. In their hurry to get away, they left their English behind. We took it as our booty and do with it whatever we want, which in fact they do. They have created beautiful variations of English, and they win every Booker Prize, mm-hmm. every English literature prize.
Well, and that's very striking. I mean, there are these famous international writers from
yes.
India, Salman Rushdie, Arundhati Roy, the list goes on. As far as
I think
I can tell,
Ireland.
They all write in English.
Yeah. Or the Irish authors who wrote in and write in English. Yeah, that is a strange phenomenon that some of those ex-colonies, and you may call Ireland that, produced very successful authors in the language of the former colonizer. I can't explain that.
What's the situation in Europe? Is English the dominant language there?
Yes. But the official language of every member state is an official language of the Union. And at present, there are 11 languages, official languages of the 15 member states, and soon that will be 20 or 24. But then in the end, English has become almost everywhere the major second language, although on the continent, it's nobody's first language.
Mm-hmm. Why is that the case? Why has English become so popular on the continent?
I think because people choose a foreign language to learn very much the way they choose a software or a music recording standard, not because it's technically the best, but they figure, well, VCR will become the winning videotape standard, or Microsoft Windows will become the most prominent software standard. I better buy that because everybody else has it too, and it allows me to communicate better. Now, this is also the reasoning in the choice of languages. And throughout Europe, the idea has taken hold that indeed English is, as they say, the language of the future. They mean the language of the labor market. And even in southern Europe now, French is being slowly pushed out by English as a second language. And in Central and Eastern Europe, German and English are competing, but English is the prestige language, and I think it will be winning.
Now, is the reason that English is so dominant in Europe, as well as in other countries around the world, is because every country has to deal with the United States? I mean, the
yes.
U.S. is the dominant global
yeah.
power now, and
yeah.
especially if you're going to have any kind of economic trade, you're going to have to deal with America, and
yeah.
therefore you have to know English.
That's right. And even if you have to deal with China or Japan, you have to learn English, because people in China and Japan who want to deal with, say, Malaysia or, say, India, learn English. So even if you don't have to deal with the U.S., you still have to learn English.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true hegemony.
Now, let's just suppose that China were to become
yeah.
the next global superpower. 100 years from now, China
yeah.
would occupy the status that the United States now has. Does that mean that Chinese would become the world's dominant language?
There certainly would be a cultural lag of, say, 50 or 100 years, the time it takes to learn the language, to be completely persuaded that, yes, China is the greatest cultural power and the greatest political power. But then in the end, yes, and even more, people would say, you know, Chinese, that's a language easy to learn, and you can say things you could never say in Dutch or in English. And it sort of swings. Because it would convey this feeling of excitement that goes with great power, and probably after a certain time that would occur with Chinese, which of course now is for us the most inaccessible language.
Abram de Swan is a sociologist at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Should English be the world's most important language? Let us know what you think. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll talk with a master of the English language, poet Billy Collins. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Billy Collins recently stepped down as America's Poet Laureate. Throughout his tenure, he campaigned to make poetry more accessible, more widely read. It's not surprising, considering his own poems grab the reader with the very first line. Billy Collins recently stopped by our studio to talk about the art of writing a poem.
I like the poem to start by saying something that I think it would be possible to actually say to someone, something you might say if you walk down to breakfast in the morning, and you could sort of begin the poem by talking to this person. So I always try to begin with normal vocabulary. And
maybe this would be a good time to ask you for an example. Pick any poem you like to start with, but the first couple of lines you say would be something you might very well say to your wife at breakfast?
Well, possibly. I mean, this is a poem called, we're out of the breakfast area here, but this is a poem called Roadside Flowers. It has a you in the beginning, a kind of general you. These are the kind you are supposed to stop to look at, as I do this morning, but just long enough so as not to carry my non-stopping around with me all day, a big medicine ball of neglect and disregard. But now I seem to be carrying my not-stopping long enough ball as I walk around the circumference of myself and up and down the angles of the day. Roadside flowers, when I get back to my room, I will make it all up to you. I will lie on my stomach and write in a notebook how light-hearted you were, pink and white among the weeds. Wild phlox, perhaps, or at least a cousin of that family, a pretty one who comes to visit every summer for 2 weeks without her parents, she who unpacks her things upstairs while I am out on the lawn throwing a ball as high as I can, catching it almost every time in my two outstretched hands.
You've taken a very ordinary feeling, which is that we're all supposed to pay attention to the little things like the roadside flowers, and run with it. There is that guilt, because you know you drove straight to work this morning, and out of the corner of your eye you saw those flowers, and most of us...
You'll get back to them later. It really is taking off on that, without saying it, that expression, don't forget to stop and smell the roses. And then I do run with it, and I try to measure the guilt about how much stopping is necessary, so that becomes fairly absurd. And then I stumbled upon the word cousin, I think, and that just set the poem off in some other direction, and I'm always looking for something in the poem that I get distracted by. It really turns out not to be distraction. It turns out to be the new direction the poem wants to go in to escape its subject matter, more or less. So we start with roadside flowers, and we end up with this kind of intriguing cousin unpacking her things.
I'm curious, I guess, at this point to know how you define poetry. And it's a huge subject, but poetry has always been defined, in my mind anyway, as minimal use of words for maximum imagery.
Mm-hmm. Another difference from prose is that prose generally asks you to stick with the topic. And in poetry, the idea really is to get away from the topic or to transcend the topic. There are so many definitions of poetry, but most of the classic ones, I've noticed, tend to have one thing in common. Like, here are a couple of examples. Dante defines it as... poetry is things that are true expressed in words that are beautiful. Carlyle calls it musical thought. Hardy calls it emotion set to measure. Now, all of those definitions imply that poetry can do two things at the same time. It can be beautiful and true. It can be thoughtful and musical at the same time. And that poetry can do almost two contrary things at once.
You again do make these leaps from the ordinary to the sublime. Sublime maybe going too far when it's the subject of throwing a ball up in the air, I don't know. But you do it quite often. There is another poem I was thinking of. Is it Litany?
There is one called Litany, yeah.
which is, I think, well, kind of a takeoff on love poems, Elizabethan love poems, in which it was assumed that in the tradition of the love sonnet that you could make a great deal of headway with the beloved if you began vigorously comparing her to...
I compare thee to a summer's day?
Yeah.
Now, litany does not do that, but it does take up that subject.
Well, litany started when I read a poem by someone and found it in a magazine, and it was one of these love poems that used comparisons. The whole poem was really just a set of comparisons. And he started out his poem this way. He says to the beloved, he says, "You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine." And I thought I would write another version of that poem, just incorporating his lines as a starting place and then seeing if I could push it in some new direction. Litany. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew on the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You are the white apron of the baker and the marsh bird suddenly in flight. However, you are not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards. And you are certainly not the pine-scented air. There is no way you are the pine-scented air. It is possible that you are the fish under the bridge, maybe even the pigeon on the general's head, but you are not even close to being the field of cornflowers at dusk. And a quick look in the mirror will show that you are neither the boots in the corner nor the boat asleep in its boathouse. It might interest you to know, speaking of the plentiful imagery of the world, that I am the sound of rain on the roof. I also happen to be the shooting star, the evening paper blowing down an alley, and the basket of chestnuts on the kitchen table. I am also the moon in the trees and the blind woman's teacup. But don't worry, I am not the bread and the knife. You are still the bread and the knife. You will always be the bread and the knife, not to mention the crystal goblet and somehow the wine.
For those of you listening, I should say that not only does Mr. Collins deliver that in a deadpan, but his face is absolutely deadpan while reading those lines. But you broke into a grin immediately after getting to the end of
Well, there's a great deal of silliness, I think, and I'm really trying to... we've just been kind of confined by the tradition of the love poem, and I think some of my poems are, the poems of rebellion written by an English major who was, just exposed to so much poetry that I'm now having fun making fun of some of those conventions.
Does a poem like this roll off your tongue from one end to the other, or do you labor to get from one place to another in it?
I pretty much break through. I mean, I pretty much keep going until I get to the end.
Have you ever done a poem like this and found yourself in the middle with nowhere to go?
Yeah, lots of times. And I think I can kind of recognize even before the middle that the poem isn't going anywhere.
Can you come back later then and fill it out? Or is a poem that doesn't go anywhere a dead end that needs to be?
I never come back. I mean, you should see my wastebasket. I mean, someone said the wastebasket is a writer's best friend. So if I have lots of false starts, poems that just don't seem to have anywhere to go or they lack momentum, there's no run of meaning, the associations aren't working. So I just generally pitch it as a bad attempt.
Has this changed in the years that you've been doing this? I thought about it because there's another poem you have called Royal Aristocrat. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it as you talked about the wadded-up poems that are in your wastebasket, because there's a line in there about using the old typewriter to iron out
right.
Papers.
It's amazing to think that before the word processor that I would type up a poem and then I'd make a change and retype the whole poem. I mean, that's probably good for poetry or good for the writer because you have to recommit yourself to every word all over again.
If you wouldn't mind reading that, I think it's a nice reminder of where you were and where you are in a way.
It's amazing to think that it's like the names of old cars, but there was a typewriter called the Royal Aristocrat, which seems a little redundant. Because if you're an aristocrat, you're a royal aristocrat.
Well, a poet can only use a royal, you'd never use an Underwood.
Right? That's right. At any rate, that's the title. It's a sort of elegy for the typewriter, Royal Aristocrat.
My old typewriter used to make so much noise, I had to put a cushion of newspaper beneath it late at night so as not to wake the whole house. Even if I closed the study door and typed only a few words at a time, the best way to work anyway, the clatter of keys was still so loud that the gray and yellow bird would wince in its cage. Some nights I could even see the moon frowning down through the winter trees. That was 20 years ago. Yet, as I write this with my soft lead pencil, I can still hear that distinctive sound, like small arms fire across a border, one burst after another, as my wife turned in her sleep. I was a single monkey trying to type the opening lines of my own Hamlet, often doing nothing more than ironing pieces of paper in the platen, then wrinkling them into balls to flick into the wicker basket. Still, at least I was making noise, adding to the great secretarial din, that chorus of clacking and bells, thousands of desks receding into the past. And that was more than can be said for the mute rooms of furniture, the speechless salt and pepper shakers, and the tall silent hedges surrounding the house. Such deep silence on those nights, just the sound of my typing and a few stars singing a song their mother sang when they were mere babies in the sky.
Of course, this is you now remembering you writing then. But do you see a difference related to the shift in time in the way that your poetry emerges now?
Well, I guess it's developed to some degree. I used to write very short poems. This is not a very illuminating observation, but my poems have gotten longer. I've had a hard time getting beyond 8 or 9 lines. The poem would just kind of do a little turn. I think I was maybe trying a little too hard to be witty or epigrammatic. I could never get a second wind. So it took quite a while to write a poem where there are a number of sort of phases and stages that the poem goes through. So I often judge poems on the strength of whether they're providing me with an emotional or imaginative ride of some kind for going from one place to another.
Billy Collins, the former poet laureate of the United States. His latest collection of poems is called 9 Horses. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to buy a cassette copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Speaking English, number 14A. If you'd like to comment on the program, just send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Anne Strainchamps, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Being a kid has never been cooler. In fact, being a kid is so cool, it's not just for the 12 and under set anymore. These days, more adults watch the Cartoon Network than CNN. Care Bears are making a comeback for the adult consumer, and Scooby-Doo underpants come in grown-up sizes at Target. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Born Again Kids. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.